Here today, we have a next generation, one of those next generation leaders who has already achieved an incredible amount in Deion Dawson. He's the founder of Deion's Chicago Dream. As many of you know, Deion has taken an incredibly innovative approach to upending how food insecurity is handled. Born in Inglewood, he and his team have already transformed that community. Their growth has already very quickly had a major and very measurable impact on the entire city. To the measurement of, we were talking, I can't keep track of the numbers anymore, but I know it's over 1 pounds. Over 1 million pounds. Somewhere between 1 and 1 million. Over 1 million pounds of fresh food and counting to those who need it. I think it's 1,300 households per week in Cook County. 1,300 households per week. Talk about impact. And thanks in part to our two other special guests here today, this effort was supported and advanced to the point where now it's becoming a national model. And for those of you who follow Deion and his awesome online presence, Deion and Danielle and the team were at the White House last month actually talking about this as this national model coming out of Chicago, right? So speaking of major impact and national models, we have two individuals with us today who are working day in and day out to better Chicagoland and far beyond through their organizations and their incredible personal journeys. Andrea Sands is with us. We all know Andrea. She was an immigrant from Ecuador and came here to Chicago and dove right into public service. After many years with the public schools, the public libraries, and a number of years at Chicago Community Trust, she now leads that organization, the Trust, which is really an organization we all know has been here for over 100 years and has had impact over those 100 years in Chicago's communities and roughly $1.5 billion of investment along the way. So we also have John Palfrey here. John's an author, educator, a legal scholar, a friend to Deion. He also has a day job. That day job is running the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, one of our country's largest philanthropic foundations based here in Chicago, with a $7 billion endowment and an impact that's arguably immeasurable. And here we are convening at the City Club of Chicago, all these folks who are making an impact and sharing this platform here to elevate that conversation and further that impact as much as we're able to do today. So these three incredible individuals are going to join us to kick off a conversation on the future of philanthropy and how we can all collaborate to grow this impact over the next generation. This is what Chicago's built on, and it's so great to be able to talk about that here today. So in that spirit of collaboration, mentorship, friendship, and civic engagement, I'd like you to all join me in a warm City Club welcome for Deion Dawson, Andrea Sands, and John Palfrey.
Good morning. I'm extremely excited to be here with you all, Andrea, John. I'd like to, you know, of course, just say thank you to you both. Getting all three of us in the same room here in Chicago is quite the feat, if I do say so myself. John is actually going to parachute out of here, and Andre is actually going to fly out, so I have to hurry up. I'm Deion Dawson, pronouns he, him, and I'm the founder and chief dreamer of Deion Chicago Dream, which is a local nonprofit. Oh, yeah. The Deion Chicago Dream is a nonprofit that fights food insecurity and is health equity focused throughout the Chicagoland area. I'm here first as a founder. I was welcomed into this community as a founder and as a leader, so of course that is the first reason why I'm here. Secondly, I'm a philanthropic leader, and I say that with pride. I say that with accountability, and I say that as a friend and colleague of these two here. I don't see myself as less than, and I'm going to make sure that this conversation conversation is eye level, as opposed to me being extremely thankful that they're here, but really to have a lighthearted discussion. And the last thing is, as a Chicagoan, I think that, you know, after COVID and, of course, the last few years, I think it's extremely important that there's a collective accountability on us all to make sure that we kind of get out of this as Chicagoans and make sure that we all get out of it together and have kind of a connectivity that kind of represents what Chicago has always been about. You know, of course, beating Detroit and other cities that think that they're better than us. But I'd like to start, actually, really quick with the definition of philanthropy, which is the desire to promote the welfare of others, expressed especially by the generous donation of money to good causes. And I bring that up because I'm brought back to a conversation that I had with Bree Perry from the Joyce Foundation. She'll remember this moment because Bree loves to correct me a lot. It was when she was telling me about a philanthropic event. And I said, well, you know, I need to be there. And she said, no, this is for philanthropic leaders. And so, you know, what I wanted to do when we level set right now is to understand that the term philanthropy has kind of evolved now. It does not mean just grant making organizations and nonprofit orgs or charitable organizations. It's kind of a combination of all three. And so, you know, what I'd like to, you know, to kind of get you to how I see it is we used to think of it kind of like DC. I know you all only bought the ticket to talk about Marvel and DC, so I'm gonna satisfy you all. We used to look at it like there's a Superman and then there's a Batman. And then there's Aquaman. But the more that we kind of get out of the pandemic, there's more of a Marvel feel to it now, to whereas everybody is playing a role, and we might not know what that role is, but then 10 years later, we hope that everything kind of makes sense and kind of meshes together. And so as we talk and as you hear me reference philanthropy, just understand that I'm referring to everybody in this room and everybody that we represent, as opposed to an archaic ideal of one or the other. And so, again, light and engaging, asking my friends a couple things. But I want to start with the most, you know, groundbreaking question. I'll start with you first, Andrea.
Just so you know, this was so not scripted.
Oh, absolutely.
No idea. What's going next.
Oh, yeah.
No prep call.
We're sitting on the edge of our seats, just like you are.
Those gonna come. Every comms team person for both of them are like, Dion, you promised. But the groundbreaking question is, how are you? And I think that I would like to ground it in understanding that we're human beings first, and it's important to, you know, make sure that we champion our well-being. So, how are you?
Thanks for that question. I'm doing pretty well, juggling some things on the home front and in the office, trying to think about all the people in my life and how much they've taken on to make Chicago a better place. Mm-hmm. And, you know, every day getting up and knowing that there's a lot that we're moving forward together and trying to find the energy to keep it going and trying to help others find the energy. That's the real answer. But I will jump in and say something else. I am a Marvel nerd, so you don't want to go deep on Marvel with me. Your opening remarks made me think of the Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Oh, yeah.
The Marvel TV show where there was a moment where there was a thing that people could breathe in and everybody could find their superhero strength. Yep. So I was following you very closely with your opening remarks.
Definitely.
It's
definitely
about all of us.
Dan, how are you?
He adapts, people. He adapts. I am well. A little nervous because I am an off-scripter, and I want to make sure that I do the job that I'm here to do. But above that, I feel phenomenal. I'm lucky to be in the city that I love. I'm lucky to lead one of the greatest organizations ever known to man. And I feel lucky to especially in Chicago. I don't... You don't get to just say you're a leader. You know, I think Chicago has to accept you. And so I'm extremely fortunate that Chicago accepted me, which is why every day you all see me dancing on LinkedIn and falling off treadmills and things like that. Good. So I feel pretty good. How about you?
You're very kind to ask. Thank you. I'm delighted to be on stage with you, not knowing what's going to happen.
Absolutely.
We just said we'll be in front of 175 people having a chat. It's recorded. No pressure. It'll be awesome. Well, I'm also looking forward later in the day to going and buying some shaving cream, which I need at a local Walgreens.
That's what I'm talking about.
When I am there, Dion, what am I going to do to add to my philanthropic endeavors today?
So what you're going to do is, after you pay for your shaving cream, because we don't want you stealing, you have a lot to lose. After you pay on the pin pad, you're going to be prompted to support Dion's Chicago Dream.
Oh my gosh, what incredible.
And even though your purchase is $7, it's going to miraculously go up to $700.
You got it.
And then they're going to give you your bag, and then they're going to talk about what type of secret agent you were when you walked out.
That's awesome. That's so good. I thought it was $5 I had to add. I don't know.
At least 10. But thank you all. Thank you all. What I wanted to do is frame this discussion in three key areas, because I think it's important not only that John, Andrea, and myself walk away with these takeaways, but everybody here. The first one is about the state of the philanthropic sector and its role in Chicago. The philanthropic sector is one of the biggest employers in the state. It's extremely important to the vitality, to the success of Chicago. And if you actually look in the background of a lot of photos throughout history, there's past philanthropic leaders in those photos. I'm just a little bit louder than some of those people that were in those photos, so I try to apologize in advance. The second thing is examining executive leadership and significant ways to support the next generation of leaders. I think it's it would not be sufficient if I'm the last leader that kind of bubbled up to be here. And I think, you know, that's why I am so appreciative of the City Club, because it's important to not only have these conversations, but for them to be inclusive and also to have a diversity of thought, diversity of background, diversity of approach, everything, because we all will ultimately get there together. And I think that that's extremely important. But the last thing is about post-pandemic. And not just seeing the philanthropic sector for what it is, but what it could be. And as leaders, all of the leaders in this room, as a leader, there's a healthy balance of realism and optimism that you have to weigh every single day. And so I want you all to have that push and pull, but it should not be set to auto drive. Every single day, you should be asking yourself, what does it require to lead today, as opposed to what does it require to lead overall? But now let's get into some questions. And there is red font on my paper, so it's going to get serious pretty quick. But just to start off, I'll start with you, John. Can you start with your organization's role in the philanthropic sector and how well you feel you execute leading that?
Wow, Dion. Yeah, getting real fast. First of all, I will say MacArthur Foundation is blessed to have an amazing staff. To your point, there are about 200 people who work for MacArthur, the bulk of whom are here in Chicago, a number of whom are here. I see Ryan K. Priester. I see Tara Magner. They're amazing people who work here, truly. I'm sure there are others who I will see or are watching on live stream. And I think it is important to note the human beings who get up every day and have to find. I'd love to come back to that hope, optimism, realism thing, because that's super important. Every day we get up, you know, the things are real that we're working on. And yet if we don't have a vision, we don't have the positive, the hope, the dream that you all carry out, I think we're missing the mark. But, you know, MacArthur's role is both to be a global philanthropy in terms of working on things like climate, which, you know, I think speaking from this place in Chicago, but recognizing our place in the world, if organizations like big charities in Chicago don't step up to help address issues and, yes, invest in places like India and invest in places like Nigeria where we operate, I think that would be a mistake. Mm-hmm. I think we all have to pitch in to save the planet in this particular case. We can argue the merits of climate change, but you know, it is the kind of thing that I think we all have to jump in on, and that's business, philanthropy, individual. But we're very much grounded here in Chicago, and I think we have one of the two things we're committed to as an enduring matter is investing in Chicago, and we've continued to invest more. We give that program a raise. We try to push as deeply as we can into being a good actor and partner. I hope we'll get into a little bit about how MacArthur and the Trust and others work together. I do think that Chicago is one of a kind in the world, truly, in philanthropy, in terms of the collaboration that exists. And I don't know that maybe our star has dimmed a little bit in terms of how people see us, but it shouldn't, and it hasn't, in terms of reality. So I'd love to come back to that, too. In terms of my grade leading, I don't know, a B, who knows? I don't think I've failed totally. And as a longtime law professor at Harvard Law School, you got to give a serious grade. So where, there's always more to be done. There's, an incredible, incredible amount for us to accomplish together. And, I think one of the great things about these jobs is you learn every single day. You live from people that you're working with. You learn from your staff, and you learn from other foundations and business. Like, it is, Andrea can say, like, these are unbelievable, mind-blowing jobs in that way. And so we're super lucky to have it and also have a sense what we're not getting to, what we're leaving on the table.
Absolutely, absolutely. Haven't failed yet. That's how I lead every day.
No, not failed as in, like, kicked out.
That's it. That's it. Andrea, talk to me about the trust and how you view it.
I'll start with just some basics. So we're a community foundation distinct from a private foundation in that we pool resources from many different donors, right? And it's a really interesting place to be because we get to work with the private foundations like MacArthur and others and get a bird's eye view into how they think about developing their own visions. And then we hang out with 1,000 donors who on a daily basis are looking to us to help them make their philanthropic contributions. And it's a really interesting place to be. We get to juggle all of those different perspectives. And as John said, it really is an enriching place to be. I feel like on a daily basis, I learn from people whose perspectives are very different from my own. And my way of looking at the world and how to solve problems is challenged, I think, in very good ways. So, there are a couple things I've been thinking about a lot in this role. I've been in the role about a year and a half now as president and CEO, and it really has challenged my sense of understanding the path. So there's a poem by a Spanish poet from early 20th century Spanish poet, and you've probably heard the line in English. In Spanish, it's caminante no hay camino, se hace el camino al andar. We make the road by walking it. And I think about that every day because there is no formula, there is no clear path to get from here to where we're headed in our work to close the racial and ethnic wealth gap in Chicago. There is no formula. Mm-hmm. There is no sort of playbook. And so every day we get to build that road. And what I've learned, which reinforces, I think, my lifelong belief, is that we do it better together when we're very inclusive. So the other quote that I think about all the time is the one about going farther together than you can. You can go fast. And I've read more recently a very specific version of that quote, which is, the young runner goes fast alone, with an elder goes more slowly, together they go far. So I thought about that a lot in thinking about today's discussion about intergenerational knowledge, because we can't just go fast, and we can't just think about the new ways of doing things. We have to remember what our elders have already learned, and we have to learn with them. And so it's just such a privileged place to be in this role, in this moment in Chicago, in the philanthropic sector, which is one, as you describe, Dion, that is inclusive. Mm-hmm. It's not just about the very well-resourced organizations or people. It is about all of us who are in this work of making Chicago better and finding a way to make that road together and to do it possibly more slowly than some of us would like, but to do it in a way that I think will get us much further than if we were going to try to do this on our own.
So then what would you say specifically Chicago social sector, what would be, a strength that stands out for you?
I think the willingness to work together. I don't see that anywhere else. John has a much more global view of places, but I've never seen such a willingness for people to collaborate on things, to not try to go it alone. I've never seen it in any sector, and it is a cross-sector thing. It is business, it is the, you know, nonprofit community, it's philanthropy, working together inside each sector and then across sectors in ways that I don't think you see anywhere else in the world.
Yeah, Deanne, I think it's one of a kind. Mm-hmm. I mean, and this is, I'm born in New York, grew up in Boston. I can't claim Chicago Pride in that way, but I can absolutely claim Chicago Pride in this way, which is, I think the default setting is, this is a big problem. How do we work together? Mm-hmm. And I just don't think that's usually it. And, I sometimes marvel, just one example with MacArthur Foundation is, has anybody ever seen the name MacArthur anywhere on any building, anywhere, any lobby, anything? Like, this is a family and a foundation that just hasn't cared about that. Like, general operate, we can get into what we do, but, you know, I think, and many other, there are so many quiet philanthropies, there's so many quiet companies, and actually, by the way, sometimes having your name and stuff is really important, and there are really reasons to do that, to be clear, including you.
What a big logo.
Big, like, like kind of your face up there everywhere. Yeah. No, I mean, there are reasons to do it, but also, I mean, I think what is, in some ways, is great is the low ego. It is less about the credit, it is more about rolling up sleeves and trying to solve something, and I think Chicago deserves way more credit than we get for that.
Absolutely. And I mean, for me, there is a willingness to work together, but there's also a passion in Chicago that's just different. And I didn't, you know, notice until we started growing and scaling as an organization. And when I would go to these other cities and talk about not just what we're doing, but what Erica Allen is doing with UGC and what Janelle St. John is doing at Growing Home and what Anton at Grow Greater is doing, it was more about me being so well versed in food and the history of Chicago. When I went to these other cities, it was a pride of like, hey, I'm not here because of me. I'm here because of my community. And so absolutely, there is a certain willingness. And then, you know, for me, I think that kind of leans into, I think, an opportunity area that kind of stood out for me when I went to the White House with Danielle. And it was in relation to making sure that there's a connectivity from the local strategy, you know, to the Chicagoland strategy, to the national and global strategy, so that we can make sure that we're all aligned. Because then the true opportunity to bring resources back to Chicago, the floodgates kind of open up. And I think that's the thing that makes me extremely proud of our team. It's not just because of what we're doing here, but because we're building a model that other cities and people around the globe can look at that started here, and they can take remnants of it and create their own. And so I would kind of open that up, Andrea, just kind of touch on something you see as an opportunity area right now in the social sector.
Oh my gosh, so many opportunity areas. I do think that Chicago has the opportunity to lead in a lot of places. And I think, you know, look at, I don't know, I'll talk about maybe the post-secondary to career world, right?
Yes.
We have so many strong leaders of the institutions that help prepare young people and adults for life and for careers. And that willingness of those institutional leaders to work with one another, to bring their teams together, to roll up their sleeves. I'm talking about, you know, the CPS to City Colleges plan that allows more and more kids in Chicago every year to earn post-secondary credentials while they're in high school. I'm talking about the ways in which, you know, City Colleges and others are working with corporate employers to create apprenticeship programs that allow young people or people in City Colleges to earn degrees while they're also working towards career pathways that used to be only open to people with bachelor's degrees, right? And are now are opening up to people who are finishing two-year degrees. I think that's an incredible feat because I know what it takes to build those, right? The kind of internal changes you have to make as a hiring manager in a corporation to make those opportunities really work and sustainable are huge. The kinds of institutional changes that are required in the, you know, public school system and in the city colleges are huge. And we've had leaders who have been willing to work on those year after year and continue to improve them. Mm-hmm. I think we have an opportunity to really lead the country in that kind of work. But that's just one example. I mean, there's so many examples.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
MacArthur, much earlier in its trajectory than I had anything to do with it, was led by one of my forebears, Adele Simmons, who is here. Adele?
Yeah, there's
here. Amazing person. And I think in addition to the wonderful mentorship she has given me in this city, you know, I think she had a point of view that MacArthur needed to be a global foundation. I think that is safe to say. And Dionne, what you just described, be grounded in the local community where she does live and connect to a national footprint, which we do, and then, you know, connect up globally. So I think exactly that strategy is a well-worn and appropriate one in Chicago. I'll take an example, again, distant from the ones we've done so far, but I think Chicago in this moment has the most exciting sector in news anywhere in America. Mm-hmm. So I think that in local news, which is a crisis, we are losing. Does anybody know how many newspapers a week we're losing in America? We are losing 2.5 newspapers per week in America every week, and it is getting faster. So we are in a crisis in local news, and so we talk about a fifth of America has what's called a news desert, where there's no local news being provided. Chicago, in my view, is a news oasis. And we can prove that, and we can support the kinds of organizations. Maple's here from Block Club, I saw earlier. Where's Maple? And just really incredible, incredible colleagues.
I love Block Club.
We love Block Club.
I love Block Club.
And, you know, I think this is a place where Chicago is showing the way. I don't know that we're getting the national credit yet for that, but I am determined that we will get the national credit for that. Like, we are going to, we can and should and must together invest in this nascent sector because it matters for every other issue we're talking about. So let me stick with food insecurity for a second. I think if you care about supporting food insecurity, you should write Dionne a check, absolutely. And I personally am on the check right
now. I did not pay him.
It's true. No, it's true.
It is true. But listen to him, please.
Listen to him for sure, yeah. But almost no matter what your issue is, if you care about climate, if you care about health care, you care about gun violence, actually having our local news environment able to tell the true stories, to tell it from diverse perspectives from every community, that is going to make everything that we're doing better. Like, being able to amplify what you all are doing every day at Dionne Chicago Dream requires people who understand the community telling that story, and telling it, by the way, nationally, right? And telling it globally. And it is going to inspire other people, other places, both to invest in the local news that is necessary for our community to be strong, but then to highlight the truly brilliant, inspiring things like your story, your personal story, your family story with Crystal, your story with Dionne Chicago Dream. Like, this is an amazing story. And if the Chicagoland environment is telling that story really well, you do it really well on social, but it needs amplification, right? That is something that no matter what we do. And by the way, we have a close-up coming right this summer. People are going to be paying more attention to Chicago this summer, right, for all sorts of reasons. This is a great time for us to be, you know, amplifying the incredible positive stories. And yes, there are people dying from gun violence. Yes, there are really terrible things happening in Chicago as well, but there are also a bunch of amazing things.
Absolutely.
And if all we're doing is showing the world that it bleeds and it leads, and that's what a shrunk down news sector is going to do, it's a terrible mistake. So one of the reasons we are investing through this effort with Andrea and others called Press Forward in local news. It's across America. And by the way, other people, other countries are copying what we're doing right now. But a deep investment of it's in Chicago, because I think we can prove what an amazing local news sector can look like in this moment and hold up the great work that you're doing.
Absolutely, absolutely. Dan, can I say damn right on the... damn right. Damn right, John. Switching gears a little bit. And of course, this is, you know... you know, about the title, and it's about intergenerational relationships, which is something that a lot of people who have been on the other end of a FaceTime call have heard me stand on my soapbox about. But I think it's important, and you two aren't, this wasn't a mistake, because I distinctly remember meeting Andrea, having a chance to meet you down at the trust office, and what immediately stood out was you treated me like a colleague. You didn't treat me as if, you know, you were blessing me with your time. We had a conversation, pulled up with the Dream Deliveries box. Y'all know that I love to do that. But we had a dialogue, and I appreciated that. And that's something that, you know, always stands out to me is your willingness to just meet with me and have a conversation. And then even with John, you know, us meeting at the Obama Foundation dinner, and then you even coming by our office just to look at what we're doing and for us to have dialogue. And there's something about the awareness, the energy, and the accountability that you two show as leaders, especially when it came to me, that I want other leaders in my generation and those coming after to understand. And so I would have to start, Andrea, you could start just a little bit about what have you seen in the leaders who are coming down the road right now, who won't take no for an answer, who are pretty determined.
Let's see. So, you know, I feel like with what I opened with, the thinking about intergenerational, like I'm now accepting that I am no longer a young leader. You know, it's taken me a minute, right? And that I am now in a position to be more of an elder and to think about how I show up for people who have all the energy, all the insights, all the will to move forward, but haven't benefited from my decades of experience, right? And figuring out how to be a support and a colleague, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I mean, I feel like I benefited from, when I was really young, being able to take positions of leadership in a nonprofit organization and being treated like an equal and like a colleague by people who were in, you know, much more senior roles for me. And that helped me really step it up and always feel like I was accountable, just as accountable as they were. And so for me, I feel like that's something that we need to continue to do. What I see young people in Chicago, all over the city, I actually don't often notice how young people are, right? Mm-hmm. I don't notice their age. I notice that there are people leading organizations, and then sort of 2 weeks later or 3 weeks later, I look up their bio and I think, oh, wow, that person just finished college, like, a decade ago, you know, or less. I see optimism. I see a sophistication that I definitely didn't have. I think social media and all of the ways in which people are exposed to sources of information beyond that which I had access mm-hmm. to when I was young create more of a sense of a complexity in the world mm-hmm. that maybe I didn't have. And I think that's great. It can lead to people being cynical. Mm-hmm. And I usually don't see the cynicism in people like you who are leading the charge, but I know that it's something we need to counter. Mm-hmm. Not sure if that answers I see a lot of great energy. I think it's all of our responsibility to give people space to lead, no matter how they are or what they're doing. I also would say that our world will change in the next decade because those folks are going to come into their own and be in very different kinds of roles. Mm. And I feel optimistic about that.
Mm. Absolutely. John.
Well, Deanne, I admit that I was sort of confused with this invitation. Maybe Andrea was too, where I was waiting for who's the other generation. Where it took me a beat to realize I was the old one, which is true. It does happen to us.
I don't think I can lead with that. You know what I mean? If I would have said, hey, John, you're the elder statesman here.
I got it. It's on us. And I do. I still like Andrea. I definitely see myself as the 30-year-old executive director. Well, so I guess it's no longer so. All right. So getting over that. And Del, if you want to join us on stage, I'll feel a whole lot better. there's a serious point around mm-hmm. that. I did have a conversation recently with a colleague who's exactly the same age. We were working on something hard. And she said to me something it was during COVID and just like sat with me really hard. She basically said, like, we're the old ones. We're the ones with the power. And I realized I was thinking that there was somebody above me who had the power and was making it. She was like, no. Like, you have to figure this out. Mm-hmm. Like, go figure it out. And so there's some, that is really an important thing. And I think partly what you're signaling here is we have to figure this out, right? Mm-hmm. And each of us have a different role. And it's no longer my role to think of myself as the 30-year-old executive director. It's just not. Like, I am in a different role. We are, those of us who are leading foundations are in a different role, different part of philanthropy, seeing at eye level, and yet also just recognizing mm-hmm. it's different to sit as the head of a big foundation than it is to sit as an executive director seeking money. And frankly, you know, I've spent 18 years trying to raise money and 4.5 years giving it away. It's really different, mm-hmm. right? Yes, we're in the same field, but it's different. And recognizing that and sort of thinking about it. And how do you make sure it is eye level? How do you, replace the replace some of those things? I have so many things I want to say in response, but specifically on your question, how do I see the my peers as the 30-year-old, no, the younger executive director and people coming up. I mean, as somebody who spent most of my life in education, that's why. It's because I totally believe that the answer to climate change is, those of us who are older have power, have to deal with what we can. But, you know, it is going to require solutions that we haven't thought of, right? Mm-hmm. We who are older have brought us to a place that I don't think is a good state of the world, whether it's on racial inequity, which we talked about earlier, whether it is on climate, whether it is on the state of local news, our democracy, you know, how too few people are, you know, are voting. Like, there are plenty of these primaries that have had 11% turnouts. Like, there are consequential things on the ballot wherever we are in the country. Like, who's our president is one, but, you know, bring Chicago home. Who's going to be in each of the important locally elected positions? Like, we're in a bad spot, and that actually is more on us than it is on you, honestly, in the sense of that we've gotten here through our leadership. So I'm just a huge believer in what, you know, how do we listen, how do we connect, how do we partner in as genuine a way as we can, given that a lot of the ideas just haven't yet been surfaced. And I think that's partly why MacArthur has both our strategic philanthropy things, where we try to pick a topic and try to go after it, and things like our fellows program, where we make people fellows. We don't know what they're going to do, but we know that they're creative and amazing, right? And we're going to and they're going to figure out something interesting. And I think we have to be open both to that really directed, we do have a point of view, we're going to play our role, and also be really be open. And like, I don't know where this is going to go, but it's going to be better than what we did.
Absolutely. And I think something that you both kind of touched on is, that I want to lift up is the need to always assess. Because I think, you know, we have our head down. I mean, this 4 years, when I started the organization, I had Obama term one hair, and now I have a lot more salt than pepper. But I think there's this willingness or lack of it to make sure that we know where we sit in the ecosystem. Because a lot of times, you know, if you have your head down or if you're trying to solve problems, you don't realize it stops with you. Yeah. Or that at the trust, you know, you have this opportunity. So I just wanted to lift that up because I think it's extremely important that not only you all, but and myself, but everybody in this room, you make sure you're assessing where you are in the food chain. Because a lot of times we're using outdated language that does not really apply to the situation or the position that we're in that we fought for years. You know, you fought 20 years to be a vice president to use entry-level language. And I think that it's extremely important that we hold that. And I kind of want to pivot a little bit to, you know, COVID and you know, some of the lessons learned and how, you know, specifically in Chicago, we saw both of your organizations pivot. You know what I mean? Of course, with MacArthur zooming in to Chicago, and of course, with the trust kind of becoming extremely nimble and kind of, you know, having new life in terms of how you view yourself. So, John, I'll start with you. Just kind of, you know, talk a little bit about, you know, some of those learnings from COVID, as well as kind of this new strategy in terms of just like really making sure that you all are taking care of home.
Thanks, yeah, Dion. So for those who didn't track philanthropy and its exact movements, we'll each talk maybe about the strategies we took. So when COVID hit in 2020 and Maggiano's had to shut down the banquets here and all the terrible things that happened, including us not getting together, you know, one thing we had to decide at MacArthur, the endowment was down too. We hit $5.6 billion, which was a low mark in March of 2020, still a lot of money, but a lot less than we had before. And we don't, unlike the trust, we don't have new money coming in. So we're just spending a, you know, percentage of that. And we made a decision to do two things at that moment, both of which were maybe counter-cyclical. One was to honor every single budget we had, so not to pull back on any. So even though we're proportionally down a lot, whatever we just said we're going to spend every dime we had planned, and many philanthropies pulled back then. And we said we're going to spend more because this is now the time when the world needs more of us. So the weird thing that philanthropy does, which is gives out more when the endowments go up and less when they go down. I said we're just doing the opposite. Mm-hmm. I realize I may get fired for this, but like this is something we have to do because the world needs us more now, and we will get a better social return on that money than we will actually when things are better, right? And so we have to do this. So we decided. Thank you. It's true. And it has forced us to change our spending program, by the way, our platform. But the other thing that happened at that moment was we decided the way we could give away more was to borrow it. So we issued $125 million in bonds, something that no big philanthropy had done at that point. We did it in partnership with a couple of others like Ford and Kellogg. And we were able to borrow money. What do you think the interest rate was at that moment for a big philanthropy? Anybody want to guess? You're getting these nice mortgages at 3 and 2, 1.29%. We borrowed $125 million for 1.29%. And the point is, like, we had the balance sheet to do that. You didn't.
Yeah.
You didn't. None of you did. We did.
I mean, me and Danielle, we gonna try. I'm gonna go. I'm gonna march right down there today. Say, hey.
Yeah. Issue some bonds. Issue, right, exactly. I think it might have been the board chair for Chicago Community Trust who helped us do it. Anyway, point was, we were in a position where we had so much money in the bank, even though it had gone down, that we could borrow incredibly cheaply and then give it away really fast. Mm-hmm. So we then, in partnership with community members, we found 12 people we did not, bless you, work with typically, and we put them in a room, and they were the advisors. One of them interviewed you here. Xavier was one of them here, and we paid the money to do it, and they guided our giving away really fast, $125 million, on a whole bunch of stuff, including doubling down here. That has affected, I think, a lot of things we've done. We added some grantees we hadn't known before. We learned a lot by entrusting colleagues in the community to do it. We also realized, I think, that we could do something counter-cyclical in this way, and we should change our spending guidelines in such a way as to try to give out more when the world needed it. And I would put up the returns, the social returns on that, way above the interest payments that we're, by the way, still making on the 1.299% that we borrowed.
Absolutely. Andrew?
So we had, as the Community Foundation, the incredible privilege of coordinating with the United Way on the citywide COVID relief fund, leaned into the generosity of many donors to try to organize that philanthropic response in a way that was really responsive in real time. So I remember getting a call from Sean at the United Way on a Friday, the Friday after everybody was sent home for 2 weeks just to see what happens. And by Monday, we had the donation website up. And by the following Friday, I believe we got our first checks out the door. Mm-hmm. And it was this incredible speed at which philanthropy never operated before, right? And we tried to continue that pace throughout. We formed an advisory committee of folks who helped us with the grant decisions. And mostly it was our team and teams of people on different foundation staffs that had their ear to the ground, that understood whose doors were open, understood who was feeding hungry people, who was responding with requests for medical equipment and things like that, and just kept the checks going out as fast as we possibly could and kept that up through the height of the pandemic. We also played a similar role as the administrative backbone for the statewide COVID relief response. And so through both of those, I think we mobilized somewhere around $90 million in that short period of time to folks who really needed it. And in all of that organizing, many colleagues got together regularly to just try to learn what was going on and had all these aha moments of like, oh, you know, do we really need these difficult hoops that people jump through before we release grant dollars? Can we lean down our processes to match maybe not exactly this, you know, crisis response, but in some ways to lean more into this trust that we're building with community leaders? And I think we've all taken those lessons in-house and thought differently about how we do philanthropy. So that was one of the things that we did during the pandemic. Focus.
Oh, somebody tried to clap. We're going to clap for that.
Clap for that.
There we go. Claps are welcome, people. It's okay. Tough crowd.
I would say one of the other things, you know, and I think that was exactly what was needed, right? So I don't think it required a clap. It was exactly what was needed in the moment, and everybody was leaning in as hard as they could. Since then, you know, I would say a lot of those relationships and collaborations among philanthropic institutions and their teams has continued, mm-hmm. right? And those relationships that were built, John alluded to some, with some organizations that might have not been on our radar before, have continued because, you know, we see them as partners. They delivered, we delivered, we're trying to figure out ways to continue that work moving forward.
Absolutely. Well, look, you both survived the gauntlet, so that goes on a resume and on LinkedIn. And now we can kind of shift towards some questions. And we'll start with a question from Erica from the Chicago Bulls, who said, many foundations are disconnected from the communities they fund. How do or can leaders close that gap so that they can better understand and prioritize the voices of those requesting the funds? And I'll let you all. You can either one.
I'm happy to start. I mean, this is something that's on our mind every day, yeah. right? We are not making good decisions if we're making them far removed from the folks that are leading the work. That's just, you know, good decision-making 101. So I would say at the Trust, since I've been there almost 6 years now, we've done a few things. We are hiring differently. We are, you know, including a knowledge and understanding, a real, genuine understanding of the communities that we focus on as part of our hiring criteria. And it is something that we take very seriously as we think about who we put into roles, especially community-facing roles. I think that changes the dynamic. Second, you know, we make sure through those folks that there is constant relationship building going on with community-based leaders and organizations, and that we're listening first before making any decisions about how to structure our grant making. Mm-hmm. And, you know, listening to what's needed. So one, you know, really easy example is the quality of life plans that LISC started, you know, supporting a long time ago, and that now many communities have built collaboratively together. We see those as blueprints for things that people have gotten together and said they think are important, and we use that to help us think about how we might support a community development project, for example. So that's just one example. And then we just stay in touch and we build relationships, right? These are human relationships, as we've talked about, that need to be nurtured, and we take seriously nurturing those relationships with community leaders.
And before you go, John, I'll just mention from the other way around, as one of those leaders, I think all of the leaders in this room, it's important how you view yourself. I don't see myself as less than. If anybody knows me, I'm shooting every shot possible, half court, layup, it does not matter. But I think when we think about this city and about where we want to go, there's a collective accountability, and there's also power at every level. And so I think it's extremely important that as we look at the power that's distributed at every level, you know, with my friends and colleagues here, there's just some things that they can say and some things that they just cannot convince me of. I know the work that I do. I know the work of our organization. I know why it's important, and nothing can shake that. And I'll stand in front of the president. I'll stand in front of these two. I'll stand in the room. I will say it before I go to bed every night, and my wife is tired of me saying it. But I think it's also important that when we think about those voices, that we continue to not allow anything to silence us, because all of the accountability is not at their level. It's also at ours as well. And I'll kind of turn it.
Such a good point, Dion, and I will answer on the merits, but just on that point, you know, one of the things that's big in philanthropy right now is thinking about trust-based philanthropy, which I happen to believe in. I think there's a lot to it, and that is, you know, in MacArthur's parlance, we give lots of general operating support. We try to have them easily renewed. People can give us reports by voice, like lots of things like that. But the trust goes both ways. And to Andrea's point, we're investing in people where, in fact, you got to get something done. Like, you can ask us to trust you and just give you the money, but you have to deliver. And, I mean, you guys are literally delivering every day, but you get the point. Like, the trust does, and I think that's actually a really important piece of this shift, I think, that you're trying to think about with the power. Two specific examples, though, that go to your question about proximity to community, which I think is really ultimately what we're talking about. And Andrea said the hiring is such a key piece of it. When you see the people you're interacting with in a foundation, you know, I'm not a great example, but in other cases within MacArthur, I think we are connected to community in that way. But two specific ones. One, many of you know a wonderful man who passed recently named Jeffrey Banks. And we're deeply, deeply sad at his loss at MacArthur and in the sector. And one of the things that he led at MacArthur with real ability and grace was multiple efforts to have participatory grant making. So Jeffrey helped to redo our Culture, Equity, and the Arts program, which used to be Arts and Culture. And he helped us shape a way that community members became the ones who make those grants. And that persists to this day. So instead of being an arts and culture program where we, from 140 South Dearborn, threw some money out the door to the, you know, big arts organizations, now people do come and apply, and we partner with the Field Foundation and others on this, but the decision makers are not me. The decision makers are community members. We don't say who they are at the beginning, so you do not go up to them in the Whole Foods or the Save-A-Lot or wherever it might be. They are allowed to say they were afterwards, but while they're making the decisions, they are anonymous, but they're community members who decide. And we just sign the checks. As long as there's not a problem, you know, we sign the checks. And that was, you know, that was Jeffrey's leadership. He also led that effort to give away that bond money led by community members in the places we were giving money. I think that's a powerful and ongoing learning, and I think that is about sharing the power and being proximate to community. But the other thing I'll say, Dion, you know, one of the ways in which I have enjoyed getting to know you after we had met at the President's event on the South Shore Cultural Center, and we you came up and were here in the Loop and MacArthur, and I, you invited me to your office, and I drove my staff and colleagues crazy by doing what I often do, which is insisting on using the CTA to get there. And when you are in the middle of a workday and you are seeking to get from where I was working to where you were working, which involves trains and a bus, and I was late, you were very gracious about it because I had not left enough time. These are things I think that you learn from as a philanthropist when you get yourself on the train and you ride down and you have to wait and the bus doesn't connect and there's nobody there and anyway and you don't know where you're going. It does help, I think, also to see, you know, people who are in our community are doing that commute the other way, and if they're running late for a meeting with me in the morning, I know a little better what that commute was and so forth. So I think there are ways in which we can change even little practices that I hope will make for a sector that's actually is more connected, is more proximate, and where we're all better, I think, at stronger relationships and doing the work better.
Absolutely. We have a question from Kristen. Start early. Well, to all of us, she said, how do you see philanthropy changing as a younger generation of high net worth individuals grows for the Chicago Community Trust? And what do you see as the role of the trust, Andrea, in reaching new younger donors and philanthropists? So I'll let you start.
Yeah, that's such a great question. And I think about that all the time. Our team thinks about that all the time. And again, realizing that I am not a young generation. We're talking about people who often, there are many families that the trust has worked with for many generations, right? And a lot of those folks are the folks who are leading the family's sort of decision making about philanthropy are maybe my parents' age. Mm-hmm. So they might be thinking about the next generation as people that are like me and John's generation. But really, really, those folks are thinking about their kids who are maybe school age now or college age now. And their worldview and their thinking about what philanthropy means, I think, is much more aligned with what we're talking about today. Mm-hmm. This, you know, effort among equals to make the world better. And so I feel like we're incredibly well equipped to bring those people in and bring them along and help them realize their own philanthropic goals, because they are totally aligned with this notion that we're all in this together. And that everybody, whether they can write a big check or just have a great idea or just roll up their sleeves and work, are part of the solution. And so we're, you know, bring it. Bring those young people down and we'll engage them and we'll make things happen.
Gotcha. Deanne, I know the question wasn't for me, but I do want to call out a couple things that I think are relevant. One is Adele's son, Ian Simmons, and others who are in that generation are doing really interesting things around impact investing. Mm-hmm. And if you are not focused on the world of impact investing, it's fascinating, awesome, super important. I think we're going to see a lot more there. It's a little bit between making grants and investing in endowment. It's seeing a different set of tools that make it possible, I think, to have huge change. So anyway, that is one. And I also think, you know, the really interesting kind of entrepreneurial spirit in a younger generation that's also philanthropic. So I would call out Abby Pucker, related to the Pritzker Pucker family, who started this thing called Gertie. If you've seen Gertie, like if you haven't seen Gertie, short for Gertrude Stein, she's created a for-profit, but that's doing really interesting, great things for Chicago, and they also give out lots of money, but they're finding ways sort of at the edges between what we've thought of as a business and what is really a civic enterprise that's really, really positive for arts and culture and the city. So check out Gertie as well. It's Gertie.
Absolutely. And you hit it right on the head. I think we've seen a shift, you know, not only in the young philanthropists, but also a lot of younger EDs. For me, I just told myself I'm not going to code switch. I think that it's important how I show up in the community. I show the same way whether I meet with John Palfrey, Andrea Sienz, or anybody else, and I think that that's carried over well, because there's a certain accountability to impact that kind of gets lost when we do the performative things. And so we're not the best when it comes to everything, but when it comes to food insecurity work, when it comes to delivery, last mile delivery, and creating jobs, we feel like, you know, we're one of the top ones in the sector. And so it's just making sure that we have that integrity mm-hmm. when it comes to meeting with these young philanthropists, because a lot of times we have conversations where we promise things that shouldn't be promised, and we agree to things that we shouldn't agree to. And so I think that there is a certain entry level into the relationship that the young philanthropists appreciate because, you know, they are on social media. You know what I mean? And they can check it and you know, do things like that. I'll take some of those questions. And you want to? Absolutely.
I thought you were here to give us the hook.
Not yet. We're going to be a couple minutes over. If anyone needs to leave, you're welcome to do that. But so hard to cut this conversation off. There were a few really great submitted questions that I'm just going to combine a couple of them to make it quick. Robert Guzman from Scale It and Gabe Lyon, also from Illinois Humanities, were asking about new arrivals and various aspects of that. But I think at the crux of it, how can the community and the philanthropic community really come together to better support the efforts to properly, you know, welcome these new arrivals and migrants that are coming to Chicago.
Do you all mind if I take that first?
You both.
I love
you.
I'd love
you're right there in the middle. Yeah, you take it.
I think first and foremost, we need to level set on the type of responses we're having. You know what I mean? I think that what we've seen is that there's been a bubble up or a lot of questioning when it comes to a lot of the resources that are deployed when we're thinking about new arrivals. But I see it as a communications issue. Mm-hmm. I think that when we see a lot of these new age entrepreneurs, we see a lot of even social enterprises not getting the contracting opportunities, not getting the chance to, you know, build that generational wealth in Black and brown communities that we're seeing when it comes to contracting during times of war or times of uncertainty. And so I think that when we think about new arrivals, it's less of a PR issue than more of making sure that as we deploy resources, it's almost the same, you know, in Inglewood. How can someone, you know, focus at school if they're hungry? How can, you know, they focus at school if they don't have any stable living? And so we want to make sure that we have comprehensive programs in place for everybody and we see an equal approach across the board, and that we're also making sure that we're tracking the metrics and what are those KPIs of success, so that then as you're reporting back to your stakeholders, you're having an eye level conversation. And so from my standpoint, I think that we have to do a better job of communicating what we plan to do, so that in the act of doing it, we can always report back in a respectful way and make sure that, you know, what success looks like is equal across the board. But I'm interested to hear what you all think.
I would just say the way that the COVID crisis really made visible the cracks in our safety net of all kinds, the arrival of 35,000 people in the last few months has shown us the cracks in our systems that help people who are experiencing homelessness. Mm-hmm. And what we're trying to lean into with our partners at the city, the state, the county, is ways that we can strengthen that system so that it can be there, as Dion says, for everyone moving forward. And there's a, you know, working it at two ways. One is trying to strengthen the system at the same time feeding people every day who are going to go hungry if we don't get it together, mm-hmm. making sure that they have access to health care, et cetera. And that's where everybody in the community all across Chicago has really rolled up their sleeves and tried to help. If you really are looking for an immediate way to help, there is something at the Trust called the Unity Fund, and we have deployed that since the Great Recession as a way to address basic critical needs. My colleague Sandy Soto is here, and she's leading that fund for us right now, and we're using it to be responsive to those critical needs day-to-day for migrants right now, and it will continue to be deployed that way moving forward.
Those are two great answers. So in the spirit of other things coming out, I am happy to talk about it later with anyone. But
okay, so I have one also from Sherry Runner, great civic leader and City Club member from the Black Research Collective. How is the attack on DEI and the political animus impeded how you give and the funding streams that you access? Mm-hmm.
Since I did not speak on the last one, I will take this one. It is such a great question. It is a terrible thing, and it has not affected our grant making at all. So we are doing exactly the same racial equity grant making that we have been doing. We believe in it. We will do it as long as we can do it. We need to be smart as a sector, as a community, and to you know, figure out our strategies, of course, as we go. But we also, you know, because there are attacks, I don't know, this feels like be long and strong and figure it out. And again, there's a lot more below that, but I think the basic message is super clear.
Thank you.
Same.
Well, that works out perfectly.
And I know it's same because we work together.
Yeah.
We don't hold back on the tough questions. Yeah. So this one is for Dion, and I don't know who asked it, but it's a good one.
Okay.
Dion, if you were leading the MacArthur Foundation or the Chicago Community Trust, what would you do differently?
All right.
What would be the most... see, I don't usually read questions without who the name of the asker or proper handwriting. What would the most urgent priorities be that you would address? And then after that, I'm going to step back, let you close out a little bit, okay?
Absolutely, absolutely. If I was leading the trust or MacArthur, what would I do differently? I mean, they're so good at what they're doing.
I only gave myself a B, Dion.
Man, listen. Oh, man, I'm in the gauntlet now. I think that, you know, first and foremost, what we've done at Dion Chicago Dream is we built a culture of listening. And so first and foremost, I think that everyone in the social sector, whether it's MacArthur or the Trust, we have to continue to evolve how we listen to our recipients and our residents. I think that only having one channel or one way of listening is wrong. You know what I mean? If we see everyone on social media, as opposed to getting upset that they're on social media, we find ways to get there to then figure out how to build relationships. And everyone here, you know, knows that, you know, I use social media as one of our major channels, but it's because it's direct to consumer. And I think that, you know, I would love to see MacArthur, the Trust, continue to evolve communication channels. I think that I would invest more in critical needs. I think that it is impossible within the society that we live in to think that someone can be successful with inflation, with you know, while also having to figure out where they're going to lay their head, what they're going to eat, if they're going to have clothing, basic necessities. And you know, even though we're in food, I think that critical needs. Growing up in Inglewood, I didn't understand that I deserved to have that stabilized. Absolutely. One more thing. I'm just really I have a penchant for really focusing on trying to make sure that leaders are equipped with everything they need to lead. And I think we all in here as leaders have realized that it's not really a either or, but a and win type of situation. And making sure that these leaders have the relationships, have the capital, have the resources to succeed, because we've seen our organization grow from no revenue in 2020 to be almost a $4 million organization. And I've seen a lot of the ways that you can get tripped up while growing, while everyone is saying, we want you to grow. And so I want to make sure that there's a route that organizations can take where they're not penalized for actually being good at what they're doing, for creating jobs, for creating programs, and also celebrating more. I think that, and listen, I am not good at this. I really love my team. I love my family. My wife is here. I'm happy she's here midday with me. But I think, you know, we have to make sure that we really celebrate these small wins a little bit more. And I won't even say small wins, just the wins, because we've lost a lot the last 3 or 4 years. We've lost a lot of people. There's been a lot of trauma. And I want to make sure that, you know, even before we get to our talking points, that we kind of, you know, hold space for everything that has shifted in the last, you know, 5 years. And so that's kind of how, you know, I would. But with that being said, thank you all for taking the time in the middle of the day on a Monday when it's apparently snowing.
It's winter.
It's winter. to take a moment to listen to this chat between Andrea and John. Thank you both. I truly, truly appreciate you all. I will never stop bugging you, though, because it's too fun. Thank you to your teams for, you know, doing all of the logistics. Thank you to the City Club for hosting this amazing chat. And this will not be the last time. I heard that Tony Preckwinkle has done quite a few, so I'm going to actually take a run at her number. You know, but more importantly, if nothing else, I hope that everyone here, you all leave understanding that Chicago is not, am I not going out? Oh, because I'm there. I'm Morgan Freeman in it now, you know. I really I got it, Jackie? Do I got permission to? That's what I'm talking about. I really hope that you all leave understanding that Chicago is ours. It's all of ours. And not only is democracy at stake, but identity is at stake. Decency, respect, all of the small things that we all, you know, didn't pay attention to as children that we kind of appreciate now. We have to hold that and make sure that we keep it with us, because conversations like this and how we, you know, conduct ourselves day to day is extremely important. So right before we go, can you all do me a favor? Can you just scoot to the front part of your seat like this for me, okay? Just scoot to the front of your seat, so that I can go home and tell my mom I had you all at the edge of your seat.